Every single day we are doing something new, and that's what keeps lighting the fire in my belly, and that's why I keep coming back. I've tried really hard to ensure that I'm as authentic as I can be in this role, but of course you bring a certain persona to work. In terms of tips for success, I mean, I'm always going to start at the logical starting point, and that's education. Our concern, however, is that we don't think there's been enough done at a government level.
The word institute might make you think of legislation rather than innovation, but today you're going to hear how Antonio Mercurella transformed a century-old institution into Queensland's hub for innovation and agent success. I've long been a fan of Antonia for the commitment and progress for real estate agents and for her fearless advocacy. Throughout her decade-long journey, she's consistently challenged the status quo, confronting hasty legislation and openly discussing leadership and parenthood challenges. As REIQ CEO, Antonia broke barriers as the first woman and youngest leader in its 100-year history. And before becoming CEO in 2014, she worked as a property lawyer, including as general counsel for South Australia's Real Estate Institute. What's really fascinating is in Antonia's 20s, she left law to work in theatre for a while, a creative pivot that enhanced her communication and negotiation skills. So what's really amazing is I think under Antonia's guidance, the REIQ has evolved into one of Australia's most forward-thinking industry bodies, spearheading legislative reforms, launching PropTech initiatives, and more. She's been a finalist for Business Person of the Year. She champions diversity as an ambassador for the Forgotten Women charity. And today we're going to explore more about how she accomplishes all of that, focusing on some practical lessons. So, Antonia, welcome to Thought Leaders.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be with you.
It's funny, I was thinking about you on the weekend. I mean, we think about you a lot because you're always in the news and all that sort of stuff. So we do think about you a lot, lead agent, but I've got something to show you. Mark and I were tidying up some boxes on the weekend and I found this.
Oh, no, let me put my... Oh, that's hysterical. That's funny. That was a long time ago. Oh,
yeah. Like, are you...
Thanks,
are you...
Sam. Thanks.
Yeah. So I feel like you all, I mean, you don't look a day over fabulous now, but I do remember when you first became CEO of the REIQ, because that was just when a lead agent was, might have been first issue or something or other. And yeah. I thought, we've got to get a hold of this woman because she's going to change things. So 10 years down the track, we're both still here. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's funny. In your little intro there, you were talking about, I always find it embarrassing when I hear that intro about I was the youngest, and I always like to qualify that by saying at the time of appointment, not so much anymore.
I think it's really a feather in your cap, though, like, you know, in such a male-dominated industry that, you know, you've earned so much respect and done so much over the 10 years. Like, I deeply research all of my guests on and, you know, it was like, she's done this, she's done this, she's done this. And even like I actually opened this magazine and was just in your first 2 years exhausted me. Like, you know, it was almost like this rocket's come in and gone, right, we're just going to shake things up. So that's my first question, actually, is after a decade leading the REIQ, what is it about the organisation now that you find is completely different to when you first came on board?
Look, what hasn't changed is who we are at our core. That's something I'm immensely respectful of. We were established over 100 years ago with the purpose of acting for the real estate community, and that remains that remains at our core, and advocacy will always remain at our core, and I'm really proud about that. But I think the way that we deliver services and products to the real estate community, I'd like to think that that has changed in a really material way. When I did take the reins, I was already at the REIQ. I'd been here for a couple of years as general counsel and then as deputy. And I remember saying when I threw my hat in the ring to become the CEO, I said I would only do it if I could modernize the REIQ and do all of the things that I thought needed to be done. And and the board said, yep, that's what we want. We want you to modernize. And about 2 years in, I remember the chair of the day saying, I think you can probably stop now. I think we're okay. I think we're in a good place. I think the modernization is complete. And I sort of refer to that conversation all the time. And We haven't stopped. And I think that's why I'm still here. I had no expectation that I would continue in this role for as long as I have. And the reason I keep coming back is that I really love my job. I'm not just saying that because I'm on something that real estate agents are watching. I genuinely love what I do. I love the variety of what we do at the REIQ. I love the significance of what we do. And we are constantly, every single day, we are doing something new. And that's what keeps lighting the fire in my belly. And that's why I keep coming back, because it feels like we are constantly reinventing ourselves, or there's a battle going on with the government, or there's something new happening, and every single day is different. You come in and you think you've got a to-do list, and then things take you by surprise, and I actually really love that about the role.
Yeah, there would never be a dull day. I mean, you know, just thinking about the last 10 years generally in real estate, we've had pandemics, we've had legislation changes, we've had all of that sort of thing. But I want to backtrack a little bit, because you did mention, well, we both mentioned that you're a lawyer by trade, and early in your career you left that secure legal path for a season in the theatre, which was a move that some people close to you sort of maybe thought, that's an interesting move.
Yeah.
But how did that detour sort of shape the way that you now communicate and ultimately lead the REIQ?
Before doing a law degree, I actually, my first degree was a theatre degree. So I did a theatre degree through Adelaide University. They had a performing arts faculty. Sadly, that degree no longer exists. So I've always had a love. I've always been a massive theatre buff. I've always enjoyed performing. This degree was more than that. You learned about the origins of theatre, and you did lots of different things across in technical theatre. So it was just the best time. And then I finished that and went to law school. And I don't know that you could get two more opposed experiences, you know, going from a very creative environment, very collaborative. Law school is quite different. And so then I graduated from law school, got admitted as a solicitor, and I was really lucky. I scored a job at what was then one of Adelaide's top commercial law firms. And it was really a law graduate's dream come true, except it wasn't my dream come true. And I was really missing being involved in the arts. And I saw that State Theatre Company had a role. It gets worse, Sam. It was only a part-time role. And the law firm, I had started as a sort of a clerk. And then they offered me a sort of a full-time lawyer role, and I said, oh, let me think about it. And instead I went for this gig with the State Theatre Company of South Australia, and it was only part-time, and I decided to take it. And I think it's fair to say that people from law school thought I was a little bit potty. And I don't know. I just, it for me, I think about that time, and it was wonderful. Like, I, to this day, it was the greatest role. It didn't pay much. Anyone who works in the arts isn't there because they're motivated by money. I can assure you of that. But I still speak, you know, just even talking about it still brings a smile to my face, because it was such a wonderful, fun role. It was a flagship theatre company. So everything happened on site. All the costumes, all the set design, lighting, all under the one roof. You would meet all the actors. And so it was this really wonderful, creative environment that I really thrived in and really enjoyed. And then I left, because I ended up leaving Adelaide and moved to Melbourne. But I loved that role. And I think really, you know, my advice to people, because I talk to a lot of young people who are leaving uni, or perhaps people who are in the early stages of their careers, and they're trying to follow this very conventional straight path. And for some people, that's great. I'm not saying that's not right. It might be right for you. It wasn't right for me. And really, that for me was the beginning of this journey that was a very curved pathway that probably had no real logic to it, if I'm honest. But I often talk about that great speech that Steve Jobs delivered to a graduating class of university students. You can find it, you can Google it. And he talks at length about this, and he talks about how he dropped out of uni and the various things he did. And so he talks about joining the dots. And sometimes in life, you instinctively know that there's something you want to do because you think you will enjoy it and you will gain some benefit from it. And I think there's value in grabbing those opportunities. And often it's only as life progresses and you continue along that career journey, and then you look back and you can actually see the value of all of these different experiences. And so when I think about my background in theatre, I had no idea how that would end up coming to benefit me in a role like this. I think my background in theatre, obviously in this role, I do a lot of advocacy work. We appear at parliamentary inquiries, Senate inquiries. I do a lot of public speaking on behalf of the REIQ. I'm in the media a lot on behalf of the REIQ. So that training and background has actually been really beneficial. And so I think I'm always a big believer in telling people to, you know, follow their dreams, follow their passions. There's always value in that from my perspective. And it's always surprising the way that you then evolve as a human being and how you're able to, at a later time, piece it all together and understand how these different experiences make you a far more complete person. And I think a better person, a more evolved person.
Yeah, definitely. Just listening to you talk, I had no idea until I did a whole lot of Googling and ChatGPTing and all that sort of thing. But I do see how having that background and that training would make you more aware of how you're communicating with other people and be able to maybe persuade them. Or, I mean, even Beyonce says she takes on a role of Sasha Fierce, you know, when she needs to go out on stage. And it's almost like, I sort of feel like sometimes it's a bit the same, that we've sort of got to put on an outfit and be in a role.
Absolutely. I've tried really hard to ensure that I'm as authentic as I can be in this role, but of course you bring a certain persona to work. You bring a certain persona to the workplace when you're dealing with your team members. I bring a really different persona if I'm having a meeting with the Premier of the state or the Housing Minister or a particular, you know, whoever it might be. So I think there's an element of that. I mean, you want to still remain true to who you are, but I think that's human nature. I think we all adopt certain personas. And just on that issue also of negotiation that you mentioned there, Sam, it's another really great example of kind of doing something and not necessarily understanding how it'll be beneficial later. One of the most valuable things I've done in my life was alternative dispute resolution training. So I've done conflict resolution, ADR training, negotiation skills. They've all got slightly different titles, but ultimately the principles of the training are the same. And I did that. I started getting interested in that. I did some of my studies over in the US, and then I worked as a court mediator on quite small claims matters. And that taught me an enormous amount about human psychology and about what we do, what motivates us to take positions. And I learned these really interesting skills at that time, and then I continued to do a little bit more training in that area. That's been probably it has been the most beneficial training in so many ways, you know, here at the REIQ, whether it be with, you know, when you're dealing with team members, when you're dealing with disputes, but even in our advocacy work. I think the ability to negotiate successfully, to understand how to overcome an impasse, how to go about trying to get people, you know, how to facilitate a conversation between people who are in a dispute, just so incredibly valuable. And again, I probably, you know, when I did that training, it was probably in the context of thinking I'd end up a lawyer, which I did for a period of time. But I hadn't stopped to think about how that training could be beneficial in relation to this role, obviously I could never have foreseen that, but even just in everyday life, I've got to say, Sam, so I'm always encouraging people to go and to learn that skill.
Sounds like a good thing for agents to do.
Oh God, yes. I am always advocating for this. I love when I meet agents. Agents will always tell me I'm a great negotiator, and I would challenge that sometimes. I think sales agents in particular are excellent at closing a deal, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're good negotiators, doesn't necessarily mean they're good at communication. I'm not saying this about all agents, but it depends on what you define as good negotiation, I guess, right? So I think it's interesting. I actually think this is stuff we should be teaching our kids from a really, really young age. It could be really beneficial. I think we'd have a far more harmonious world as well.
I'm going to go and look into it myself now.
Yes, like, absolutely.
Just made a note, but let's talk about the modernization of the REIQ because, you know, like I'm looking at you now and you're the logo and everything like that. I've seen so many changes. What was the first decision that kickstarted this modernization? Do you remember the moment?
Yeah, I remember it really clearly, and it's really nothing sexy. In fact, it couldn't be less sexy. And it's going to sound like a very lawyer-like response, but one of the very first things we did when I became CEO, I knew that we needed to get our corporate governance, that foundation stuff right. And that sounds really boring, but it's critical. And what I mean by that, when I talk about corporate governance, it means effectively what is happening in the boardroom where it all starts, because that's how you set the culture for the organization, and it's where strategy starts as well. And so it was really about looking at, obviously I had been involved behind the scenes because of my role as general counsel. So I knew we needed to get better at providing our board directors with really good, accurate, clear information, financial information and other information, so that we could actually make really well-informed decisions. Because if you haven't got good reporting, then it all falls apart. So it sounds boring, but it's critically important. And then it's about really understanding what's the status of our organization and where are we now and where do we want to be? And obviously that means we need to have the right people in the room. So part of that refresh was around making some really controversial decisions. We had two rounds of constitutional reform where I thought it was incredibly important that we had a boardroom that was representative of the people that we represent. And so that meant diversity in terms of ages, in terms of gender, in terms of sectors, in terms of regional, non-regional. So we've gone through a couple of rounds of constitutional reform, but it's really just about making sure that you've got those foundations right and that you're coming into the boardroom and you're having conversations about the right things, about strategic direction. I think what happens with membership bodies and associations is they're often run by really well-intentioned people. They're usually members. They're not always remunerated. And if they are, it's not always great remuneration. And so you really want to make sure you've got quality people around that boardroom. And so we did a lot of work in relation to that. And once you've got that, you know, I keep saying foundation, but that's really what it is. Then from there, you can really build and you can, that's where the magic really starts to happen. And it's really interesting because I think it's not the answer people expect me to give. But just to be clear, from there, what we were able to do is where the fun did start to kick in is we started to have conversations about, okay, well, who do we want to be? And so, for example, we started to do things like we would hold so many events, Sam. It was just Event City, but they weren't quality events. So we made a decision that we really wanted to be known for good quality events. So we actually started to do less, but we started to get really serious about the quality of our speakers, the quality of our venues. And I look at where we are today and I'm so proud, like the caliber of our events. I feel like we're known for that across Australia. We have an amazing events manager who heads up our events team. You know, we knew we wanted to modernise our registered training organisation, our RTO. So, you know, today we've gone from having dedicated massive training rooms Now, we do training in person if that's what people want, but we hire venues for that. The majority of our students want to learn online, so we've built this amazing online platform that allows you to learn at your own pace, and it's a really great experience, and it's the experience that I think you need to be having in this day and age. So, but we were only able to start making those really big changes because the board felt like we were really clear. We were doing things in the right order. We were actually putting together proper business cases. We were doing research on things before we were just jumping in and making decisions about what we were going to do or not going to do. So all of that for me comes back to really good, solid corporate governance.
Yeah, well, my mum used to say you can't build castles on quicksand. So, you know, having the good foundation is actually a really good tip for anyone to take away, even, again, real estate agency owners.
Yeah.
But digging into some of the other things, I mean, RealWorks, what role did the REIQ play in shaping its features, and how did you get such rapid adoption?
Yeah, I'm really proud of RealWorks. This is really a massive success story for REIQ. So there's a few things I'll say about this. Probably what I'll start with, which is I'll acknowledge, probably quite controversial. We are a membership body, but we're also a peak body. So a decision we made a long time ago was to actually allow those forms to be used by all real estate practitioners in Queensland, whether they were members of the REIQ or not. And as a result of that decision, we now have virtually every practicing real estate agent and business using those forms. Now, that's incredibly important because those forms, you know, and the number of forms that are in there has grown exponentially over the last 5 years in particular. And what we're able to do is we're able to put together these forms that guide good compliance, that enable compliance, that reflect best industry practice. And as a result, we're able to elevate all real estate agents in some way to a standard level. And I think that's really important. And I'm really, really proud of that. It also means that even if you're not a member of the REIQ because you choose not to be, we'd like you to be, but we respect that you've not made that decision. We're still engaging with you. And so what it means is that as a peak body, we're in this really unique position that many membership bodies aren't in, where we've got this extraordinarily high level of engagement with the people we represent. Now, that's so valuable when it comes to advocacy and to being able to say that we speak on behalf of, you know, thousands of real estate professionals all across Queensland. So I think the other thing I'd say about RealWorks is, you know, we went from, I remember when I joined, our forms platform was being delivered by a CD-ROM. There'll be people watching this webinar who are going, I don't even know what that means. I'm revealing my age. And it was dreadful. And so one of the first things I did was move to this cloud-based platform, which meant you could use the forms wherever you were, whether you were sitting in your office or sitting at home or wherever you happened to be. So I think that was a real game changer. I know that in 2025, that sounds ridiculous, but for its time, it was a game changer. And I think just I'm really proud of the way we've constantly evolved that forms platform to add new functionality, to add new forms, the way that we're allowing our users to tell us what's not in there, what they do want in there. And it's just a really nice package. It gives you all the forms you need, irrespective of the sector you work in. It's an extraordinarily good product that does really important. What it does is so important. I sometimes think about the gravity of that product and its significance. It's the platform that allows you to facilitate virtually every sales contract in Queensland and most of the general tenancy agreements, most of the residential tenancies that people enter into. And I think that's pretty extraordinary that we are providing the forms that allow these transactions that ensure that Queenslanders at the end of the day have shelter over their heads. And so I go, here we are, we're quite a small organisation, but we're doing really, really big, really important work. Yeah.
Yeah. Mighty work. Mighty work, I would say.
Yeah.
So speaking of some mighty work on your part and probably a lot of other people, is Queensland's new seller disclosure regime lands very soon on the 1st of August. So what are the, like, three things that you think agencies have got to do now to stay compliant and keep deals moving?
I mean, this is such a significant change in Queensland. For people in other jurisdictions, agents in other jurisdictions, that they probably won't understand the fuss because they've had statutory disclosure regimes for a long time. But for our crew, it's a really big shift. And so in terms of tips for success, I mean, I'm always going to start at the logical starting point, and that's education. Anyone who is selling needs to understand what these new laws say. We've obviously developed an enormous amount of educational materials and resources to aid that process. So the first step is always making sure that you're informed and educated. The second is really making a decision about what's the approach your business will take to the regime. Are you going to take the approach of, we don't want to prepare them, we're going to delegate them from day one to another party? Or are you going to be a business that actually decides, actually, we do want to be involved in the preparation of these documents. And if so, how are we going to do that? And it's about then selecting the model. And again, we've got a solution, as you would expect, that we're incorporating into RealWorks, where those agents who want to be putting together those seller disclosure documents will have a tool that enables them to do that really, really easily. And then the third piece is really around the client-facing interaction. There has been really no education at government level. And so it will be important. Real estate agents will need to educate and guide their sellers. And so there'll be some pushback from sellers because it will involve expense, and it will mean that agents need to factor in when the seller disclosure document will be prepared in their process, in the chain of activities. So I think getting that conversation right will be of key importance.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, and I think I don't think you were a fan of the bill too much in its early days. Are there any landmines in it perhaps that agents don't see coming?
There's always that in any legislation, and you know, one of my favourite sayings is the devil's in the detail. In terms of our position on this issue, our starting point, keeping in mind that this has taken over a decade, so it hasn't happened overnight. The REIQ took the view that there was a benefit associated with introducing a seller disclosure regime in Queensland. It exists in most Australian jurisdictions. So our starting point was, we're supportive of it, but that was predicated on some fairly important principles. Firstly, we didn't want it to be incredibly onerous. We didn't want it to be expensive or we knew there'd be a cost, but we wanted it to be a reasonable cost. And then I think thirdly, it was really about ensuring that this thing didn't evolve in a way that it actually became a barrier to the process. And sadly, even though we did start as being advocates for it, and I would say still to this day, the principle of it we support. Our concern, however, is that we don't think there's been enough done at a government level. So what we mean by that is there hasn't been the right education campaign. And of course, that will mean that we and the real estate profession is left to do most of the heavy lifting. But the other really concerning thing is that there's no infrastructural support around it, Sam. And that's really important because we're really concerned. Queensland is a really unique state. And so what we're really worried about is that the experience will vary depending on where the property is located. So we know that there's certain information that needs to come from local government. There will be some local governments that simply, they're going to really struggle under the weight of this. They don't have the resources. We also wanted a consistent experience. So that concerns us that, again, a property in the middle of Brisbane is probably going to be okay. You're probably going to be able to access all the relevant documentation and information you need. That's going to be different to a property in the middle of rural Queensland or regional Queensland. So that's concerning to us. So again, that's where the detail is. And so, but the reality is it'll start in a few weeks. It starts on the 1st of August. It'll be a bit of a white knuckle ride, I think, for many agents in the early days. I'd like to think, though, that with us in their corner, we're going to be able to help guide them through. And look, it's not a new experience. I think whenever government introduces new legislation that adds an administrative requirement, of course, like, we understand people don't want change. Real estate agents don't want change. No one wakes up and goes, gosh, I hope someone's going to come along and make my job that little bit harder today. I'm really looking forward to that. So it's what we do. It's what we've been doing for over a century, Sam. So we'll be in their corner guiding them along the way.
Yeah, that's good to know. There's so many other things that are going on too. Like, so mandatory CPD has become compulsory in Queensland from the 6th of June. So for anyone who's sort of been living under a rock somewhere, do you want to just give a quick outline of what the requirement is? And I guess how you can use it for competitive advantage, because I've had a look at the stuff and I think that, you know, like, you've really tried to make a program that is creating competitive advantage for agents, not just compliance for the sake of it.
Yeah, I think that's so important. So we have been advocates for this for many years. And again, there'll be some critics of it. For us, it's about professionalism. I feel very strongly about continuous learning. I think we're kidding ourselves. Real estate professionals are engaged in really significant transactions. And this notion that you can do a quick course and then never have to step foot into a classroom or not continue to learn, I just think that's very unrealistic and actually quite dangerous. So again, we've been advocates for the introduction of CPD. But what we were really clear about, Sam, is we didn't want to tick a box, and we don't want it to be just about compliance. We know that real estate legislation will always have consumer protection at its core. So what we said and what we got was we said a certain component of it does need to be risk and compliance focused. And so some of it comes from needs to be a particular type of training, and that is that sort of accredited training. And so it's quite prescriptive and it does tend to be more focused on risk and compliance. And then we said to the then attorney and to the Office of Fair Trading, there should be a second column where there's flexibility, and that's again where we've landed. And in that column, Sam, it could be negotiation skills, it could be how to develop great communication skills, it could be about customer excellence, it could be about marketing. So there's a lot more flexibility in that second column. And obviously the training does need to be approved by the Office of Fair Trading, but definitely in that latter column, that's where you're getting a lot more flexibility, and that's where you'll be able to learn things that are of interest to you and are beneficial, but they're not necessarily under that banner of just risk and compliance. So I'm actually pretty happy with where the model's landed. It's not terribly onerous. As a general rule, the guidance that's been issued is that you've got to do one from each of those categories, and they're probably about 3 hours each. So in other words, annually, it starts at a mere 6 hours. So anyone who tries to argue with me about the fact that it's outrageous and unreasonable, you know, I'm happy to have that debate any day of the week.
We live in a time when things are changing so quickly and consumer expectations are getting more onerous. And I think if you're not always learning, then, you know, you risk being left behind anyway. So, you know, it's...
I think so too. And I think I'm always amazed at when people argue that they shouldn't have to do any more training. I'm always amazed at that concept, because I think if you think about what real estate agents do, it's arguably some of the most significant work you could do. You're selling people's most significant asset as a general rule. You're putting people into a rental property governed by really strict laws. You're facilitating contracts. You know, that's a privilege we have here in Queensland that not every real estate agent gets around the country. The fact that a real estate salesperson in Queensland can negotiate a deal and then sit down and prepare the contract all the way through to execution, That's usually a right that's reserved for a lawyer. So I think if we want to be regarded, held in high regard, then that comes with responsibility. And I think doing some annual training is from my perspective, entirely reasonable and very appropriate.
Speaking of some of the changes, I want to talk about AI because you and I sort of had a bit of a chat at a domain event recently, and I thought some of your takes on, you know, how AI is changing the industry was very interesting and should be heard by more people than just Queenslanders. But I want to ask you first, what do you feel like is the most surprising or creative use of AI you've seen in the real estate industry lately?
That's a good question. I think where I think it's being used a lot, but it's not terribly creative, to be honest, is to write copy. I think a lot of agents are using it for that purpose. I think an area where it's particularly creative is this, but it also terrifies me, so I'll qualify it. And that's where you can create a video using your voice, your tone, and you can convert it into another language. And the reason I think that's extraordinarily useful is I think about Queensland, but I think about Australia on the whole. We have such a multicultural society, and I love the idea that I could film a video about the property, and I might film that in my native language, which is English. I might do it in Italian, but then beyond that, I speak no other languages. But for example, the property might be located in, let's call it Sunnybank Hills, which is a suburb here in Queensland with a really large Chinese population. I know that, you know, this is going to be an appealing property potentially to them. The fact that I can convert that video into Mandarin and it still sounds like me when I don't speak a word of Mandarin, I think that's an example of AI being used in a way that's incredibly useful to the person who's then getting the benefit of that video. But it just means that all of a sudden you can sort of open up your marketing to this much, much larger group. And, you know, normally to do that, you'd have to go to a translator, or I know that a lot of businesses where they're based, where they do a lot of work in a particular community, they might actually specifically recruit and employ someone with that set of language skills. So I think that's just a really kind of nifty example of how it can be used, albeit that I do find that really terrifying. Because as a lawyer, I'm thinking about the risks and how that could, you know, you could use it for good, but you could also use it for evil, right?
Yeah, absolutely. What would be your non-negotiables for real estate, for data privacy and ethical use of AI?
Yeah, this is such a good question and touches on some of the things that you and I talked about at the Domain event. I think technology and AI, I think we've got to make sure that we're being respectful of the way we use these tools. We've got to understand that we live in a world where privacy and data protection is becoming increasingly important, and the laws surrounding that are becoming more and more, they're so strict, and the penalties and risks are pretty extreme. So I'm okay with all of this, but for me, it all comes back to the basic principle of consent. And it's actually not hard. It's just about setting up certain structures at the very outset. So I think if you explain to people what you intend to do with their data or what you intend to do with their personal information, if they're comfortable with that, they understand the purpose for which it's given and how it will then be used, and they're okay with that, then away we go. I don't think it's hard. I'm hearing about agents who are recording conversations again with consent. And I think human beings just want to understand. So if you're saying to me, hey, Antonia, I'm going to be recording this today for these reasons, and you've explained that to me, I'm probably going to say yes to that, and I'm probably going to be okay with that. So I think sometimes when I've been speaking about this issue, people are thinking I'm anti-tech or anti-AI. I'm not, but I am, you know, ultimately my legal training probably kicks in, and wearing my REIQ peak body hat, because if you're not doing that properly, you can imagine that the consequences can be quite dire. And it's not just about one real estate agent, as I think we all know, one real estate agent doing the wrong thing and ending up in the papers means that the community decides that all real estate agents or the majority of real estate agents are doing that thing. So I think it just comes down to making sure that you're doing a bit of pre-work before you just start blindly using things. And you don't have to be an expert on everything. There are people out there who can train you in how to do these things, how to do them legally, ethically. So it's not impossible. It's not insurmountable. And I don't think we're suggesting putting all these roadblocks in that make the process really expensive or really laborious. It's really a bit of a making sure that you're setting it up from the very outset and then away you go.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's look to the future now. So we've got an exciting period ahead of us here in Queensland with the Olympics coming up in 2032. Mm. What will, obviously it will have hopefully a positive effect on a whole range of things in this state, but what will Queensland's top 10% of agencies be doing, do you think, in 2032 that today's average operator can't even picture yet?
That's a really tricky question. I think, I don't know that I know the answer, if I'm honest, but here's what I think agents should be doing. If agents want to be future focused and thinking about how are they going to remain competitive, knowing what we know in terms of how quickly technology is evolving, and in particular, you've mentioned Queensland, the landscape and how it's changing here in Queensland, I would strongly recommend that real estate agents are thinking well outside the box of real estate. So real estate agents often go to training, but respectfully, they'll often go listen to the same people. They'll often focus on listening to people who are currently very successful in real estate. Now, there's a place for that. I'm not saying you shouldn't be doing that. But I think real estate agents who are forward thinking should be doing this. And it's actually reading, listening, attending, training sessions, webinars, videos, presentations, articles, whatever, like whatever the medium is. But outside of real estate, I actually think that, and this is what I try and do and what I encourage my team to do, what is happening in the broader world that has nothing at all to do with real estate? What technology is emerging in medicine? What trend is emerging? And so it's about what's happening in the broader world around us that's changing the way consumers act and feel and what they expect. And then it's about taking those learnings and going, oh, how could I apply that in a real estate context? Because then you're doing things that every other real estate agent isn't doing. So, I mean, I've been working in the real estate sector now for, it's coming up to, you know, it's 20 plus years, and real estate agents tend to have a habit of following others. So there'll be those trailblazing real estate agents who try something and then every other real estate agent goes, oh, I'm going to do what they're doing. And that's fine. That happens, but you want to be that trailblazer. You want to be doing something that nobody else is doing. And I don't know that you're going to be able to do that if you've got this kind of very narrow lens around what's happening just in real estate in my world. I think you need to be looking much, much further outside of your world and thinking about how that thing will potentially have an impact on the way that real estate is transacted and what consumers are going to expect in the future.
Yeah, you just reminded me of a quote I heard on the podcast last year, and I can't remember who it was, but you can only imitate your way to good. Like, you can never imitate your way to amazing. Like, you can only imitate your way to good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. This is probably, you know, like one of my, I could sit and talk to you all day, but in the interest of time, this will be my last sort of real question. You were the first female to head an Australian Real Estate Institute. And since then, we've seen a wave of female CEOs and presidents follow. What do you feel unlocked that momentum, and what structural change do you think would further accelerate diverse leadership across the industry?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it's really important. Like, we know that there are so many successful women in real estate. And so I think it's really important that we're now seeing them in those leadership roles. I'd like to think that that becomes an inspiration, that it makes people feel like they too can aspire to leadership roles. So I think that's really important. There's something about just getting the ball rolling sometimes, right? I'd like to think that I got the ball rolling and then it just kind of a momentum starts. And then it becomes, ideally, we don't have this conversation at all. I'd prefer not to have a conversation about the fact that I happen to be a female and I'm in a leadership role. So that's ideally where we want to get to. I think what's really important and something that has become even more important to me as I've gotten older is I think we've really got to make sure that we are encouraging younger women. I talk a lot about this. I think it's about having really honest conversations about the challenges of juggling work and parenthood. I think so that we're not creating this false illusion that it's easy. I think they're important conversations. So I think honesty plays a role in that. But I think we've got a responsibility, whether you're a man or a woman, I might add, if you've identified a woman, a young woman or a woman generally who's aspiring to achieve something. I love when my team come to me and say, Antonia, I want to go from here and this is where I'd like to be. And I really love the opportunity to help them to get there. And so I think it's really important that that's the role we're playing, that we are helping people and giving them some guidance along the way for the steps that they might need to take and some of the things that they might encounter and trying to get them prepared for that mentally. And I think we've just got to keep doing that. I don't think that there's anything extraordinary in that answer. It kind of feels like it's common sense, but I think we forget these things, and I always try and, you know, I'm probably at a stage now where that's the stuff I really enjoy doing. I really enjoy helping others to progress in their career and to grow professionally. And I've done quite a bit of mentoring with different people over the years, which, you know, it's supposed to be for them, but I actually think I get probably just as much value out of it as they do. And I just think that's really important, because it's something I'm always reminded of is the impact that someone can have on your life. I think we don't always understand the impact we can have on others. We're so busy doing the things that we do, and we don't understand that giving some guidance and support can be all the difference to someone. And so that's what I try and remember all the time. And that's how I try and do my bit to help others to achieve what they're hoping to achieve.
Yeah, well, I feel like you can't be it if you can't see it. And I know you're an inspiration to a lot of women in the industry. So I want to thank you, firstly, for coming on the show, because I know you're an incredibly busy person and we would like to see more of you. Like, you know, there's so much that we've talked about today. We've covered so much ground. So I just want to thank you for that. And I guess my final question is always this: if there was one thing or one piece of action that you would like people to take away from listening to this today, what would it be?
Oh, goodness. Okay. Well, look, probably not surprisingly, something that I talk a lot about is, and something that we're very committed to, and I'm personally very committed to, is finding ways to ensure that the community holds the real estate profession in higher regard. And often in this role, people say to me, Antonia, it's your job to make sure real estate agents are better and they're doing the right thing. And my response is, you're giving me way too much credit. I can't do that single-handedly. I absolutely have a role to play in that. But I believe that every single real estate practitioner in this state and indeed around the country wears that responsibility. And if all of us can make a committed effort to be better and to call out bad behaviour, I think that goes a long way to really raising the perceptions of real estate agents And just really allowing real estate agents to go home at night feeling like, as they should be, that they're doing really good, important work and that the community holds them in high regard. So that, for me, remains front and centre in terms of what we're about.
Yeah, amazing. That is great advice. Antonia Mercarella, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.